Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. With an African-American about to take over the presidency for the first time in American history, the subject of race is one that just will not go away. It was a very prominent part of the campaign in both intellectual ways and in very ugly ways as a topic of discussion and in imagery, verbal imagery and also photographic caricature imagery. The Time magazine cover photo of O.J. Simpson that seemed unnecessarily darkened comes to mind as a possible image. Juxtapose that with the New Time cover photo that turned Barack Obama into FDR. Perhaps they should have taken the cigarette holder out. Obama's trying to quit smoking. We're going to discuss race and photographic imagery with Chris Harris of the Department of Electronic Media Communication, our old friend who likes to talk about pictures and what pictures say. Thanks, Chris, for being here.
It's a pleasure once again.
How does a photographer avoid, or does a photographer have to be worried about being politically correct when shooting photographs of the first African-American president of the United States, which may not necessarily turn out to be flattering because inevitably they will catch him in some unguarded moments?
Well, quite frankly, it is not different whether you're black or white. We can always photographers can rate themselves as to where they stand in the hierarchy of photojournalism by how many times they've been caught taking those pictures that don't mean anything but can cause hysterical laughter or derision or anywhere in between. What I mean by that is there was a time that Richard Nixon kicked his press secretary in the rear end, going into a meeting. Well, that was just a boss who was upset with one of his subordinates, and he hauled off and just let him have it right in the can, and that became a much wanted picture. Whether it's black or white, the traps that a photographer would fall into would be things like getting them when they're scratching their face and makes it look like they're picking their nose or from a different angle or any of those normal things that occur. You can get people in talking. You can shoot off a sequence of 5 or 10 still photographs, and one of those may have his mouth or her mouth in an awkward position or something on that order. Let me give you a real, I was going to give you a real solid example, but let me again still speak to this idea that a good photographer isn't going to let those kind of pictures go out on his watch, and that is, or her watch. The whole deal has to do with photography is there to visually guarantee that something did occur. Usually it's using conjunctions with words that come from a newspaper reporter or a reporter of some sort. So visually what you're able to do is say, no, this is, yes, they actually were there, and this confirms what you've just read in your writing. Quite often we have these horrible pictures, these shaking hands of two public leaders, and all of a sudden there's 50 press corps in there and they're all taking pictures. What's the value of a picture of President Bush meeting with somebody from not even maybe a head of state, but somebody from another country? Well, it's only there to prove that it did occur. So those kinds of pictures aren't worth very much. Well, when you get into the idea of using race, not using race, but having race influence your images, it becomes a little bit different. Usually it's not just a photograph of the subject itself, but it will be the subject in counterbalance with either another a child or someone from a different race. So it shows the interracial situation of a black president-elect hugging a little Chinese baby, okay, mm-hmm. Something on that order. race has an odd quality to it. In fact, I was talking earlier at a Monday sort of coffee group that we have over in MassCom building about the pictures that we had that came out of this last election. Now, I'm going to bypass race here for just a moment because I want to. Here we had what was obviously a racial situation by definition. We had a black man and a white man running. Certainly by the old days definitions, that's a hot ticket right there, okay? Mm-hmm. Obama, I don't think, ever exploited his blackness in his imagery.
He did not. As a matter of fact, he tried to project the image of a post-racial society of which he would be a part. But there were surrogates of the loyal opposition, perhaps not directly connected to John McCain, but on the periphery of John McCain's campaign, who used race in a negative way.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. What I'm talking about is the standard bearers of photojournalism. I'm talking about the AP, the Reuters, the Agency France-Presse still photographers. I'm talking about Getty as a still photographer. And then, of course, you have photojournalism in the video arena, of which all the networks, all the different local stations would show up with camera people and everything else. One thing I did, I was asking this group this morning, I said, name three images that come to mind from the election. Not a single one of them had race as the issue, except in a very minor way. The one that was common to almost two that were common to almost everybody I asked about this, and I asked about five or six different people, graduating seniors as well as senior faculty, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the two that came to mind, first of all, and one actually does have some little tinge of race to it, but it's almost overridden by what actually occurred, and that was the famous bump photograph. The photograph of Michelle Obama and the president-elect bumping their hands. Well, that bumping of hands started off to be a sign that was accepted perhaps in the black community before it was in the white community, where handshakes would have been normal. Here it made it into commonplace. It made it into just the regular reactions of regular people in the United States. So that, of all things, where it had racial roots perhaps, became the commonplace. It became, oh, well, they're one of us. They do their hand bump, okay? The other photograph that commonly came out and I think does have a lot of racial implications in it, but in a very, very positive manner, is whether it was still or video, the pictures of Reverend Jesse Jackson at Grant Park on the night that Obama came and spoke. Tears running down his face. Jesse Jackson, if you aren't well aware of it, if there's a camera, Jesse Jackson will find it, okay? He has this rich history of self-politicizing and public, you know, his images out.
It has ever been thus, yes.
But I've got to say that the most rewarding image ever of Jesse Jackson had to be this one, and it was one that he did not control. It was one that he had really nothing to do with other than you could see the American African-American black struggle of the Martin Luther King era, realizing the fruition of all that everybody went through from the 60s and 70s, and of course, millennia before that, I mean, of everybody trying to stand up for the rights of the black man, etc. And it showed on his face.
There are cynics who will say that the reason Jesse was crying is because he wanted to be the first African-American president, but I'm not going to believe that Reverend Jackson is that shallow.
Oh, I don't think, again, we're talking personally, I guess.
Right.
No, I don't think he's that shallow. In fact, I covered his previous presidential campaign. I was with Time magazine at the time covered him for that. And he was a very serious contender. He never was one of those that was just, I'm black and therefore I'm running and therefore there's At least we're starting to get a black into the political scene.
He not only had something to say, he took it into Appalachia and delivered it to poor whites and reached out to them as well.
Absolutely, which I guess is where his push coalition, this idea of the Rainbow Coalition, maybe either took effect or was proven that he was really committed to that. You know, Gandhi had his nonviolence. One thing that you can say about Jesse Jackson is that he seemed to be pretty open to any kind of racial input that would make it into a better whole.
Mm-hmm.
Those people that would say that he was looking at it as thinking that that was him, I think misread it.
Mm-hmm.
I truly do, because I think that that visual speaks highly of the background and the importance of what this truly was. Now, you talked about the photographs dealing with Obama on Time magazine, and then this occurs very few years in the span of time after they did such a hatchet job on O.J. Simpson. Now, I'm not talking about whether or not we should believe that O.J. Simpson committed the murders or not. The facts of the matter are that Time magazine, and by the way, Newsweek ran the cover at the same time, and basically it was the same thing. It was the same mugshot. Time magazine absolutely made it as though this was an ADT ad. You know, somebody's kicking in your front door. This
right.
is that burly black man who, by the way, the numbers that he was holding up, you know, for his regular mugshot, they were enlarged. He was made to look very dark and swarthy. There are some people who claim that the M actually sort of looks like devil's horns coming out of the back of his head.
Oh, good heavens.
Things like this. Newsweek ran the picture straight. And after all, what more of an indictment could you have against a person other than running their mugshot? This means that they are a common criminal, not something special. Time magazine far went beyond their bounds on both ethics and maybe even some law on this. I don't
yeah.
know. But what you've done is, you know, a magazine cover is considered different than the inside. The outside is actually considered advertising, so that's how they got away with doing almost a parody of the arrest mugshot. Then you come back to what Time magazine did this time with the FDR lookalike, basically. And what you get is one group sensationalizing something, making it somehow changing the image, making it into something that they wanted to project, as opposed to being a news magazine. And again, these are my thoughts, but I've also let Time Life know about this. I mean, I write them quite consistently.
I'm sure you're not the only one.
I would suspect not, because the differences are so obvious. I'm not pushing Newsweek magazine, but at the same time, take any issue of Time and compare it to Newsweek. If they have the same common topic on that cover, Time will sensationalize it. They will somehow add to it. They will add embroidery to the effect of the visual. And that's not often necessary. We have wonderful images. Again, I can't get away from that Jesse Jackson image. That Jesse Jackson image sums up to me as I'm a white person, okay,
mm-hmm.
older white male. I covered civil rights from 1969, which was at the end of the civil rights era. But don't forget that just because the Civil Rights Act was passed in 65 doesn't mean that any real action had occurred by 69.
Right.
We're still talking about the very closely guarding to the conservatives' vest the idea that we aren't going to change. Well, Jesse Jackson, by running, I think it was, what was it? Was it the 80 or 82? Maybe it wasn't 76.
He ran in 84.
84.
And again in 88, less successfully than in 84.
Right. But 84, what he was doing was he was testing the water, not just for a black, I don't think, but rather for anybody with new ideas coming in. And if you notice, Obama didn't run on being a black. He ran on his ideas.
But in the 80s, there was not the kind of technology available then to manipulate images that is available today, the digital technology. And if a mainstream publication like Time can do what they did with O.J. Simpson, which is was only, what, 10, you know, 12 years ago when the criminal trial was held. All kinds of media, both mainstream and fringe, can manipulate images both, you know, physically to make them look different and contextually. You know, I think we saw this with one of the McCain ads that said that while McCain was helping the troops, Obama went and played basketball. Well, what the ad didn't tell you was that he was playing basketball with American troops in Kuwait.
Right.
It just shows the
image.
Which,
by the way, shows the validity of photography.
Yeah.
Shows the validity of why you have a visual press corps there. Because people had actually seen, oh, yeah. In fact, he was shooting around the key. You know, he was doing his standard high school in the basketball lot game. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it was picked up that way. I want to take a step a little bit further about, you're so correct about what has happened with Photoshop is basically the software we're talking about. Although now there's free software out there that will do a lot of the same things. But the guardianship of what gets out as imagery is now such an important issue, and it is not being addressed very well by any news service, as far as I can tell.
Who is the gatekeeper of the imagery?
Well, it should be the photo editor who selects the image for the use, assists on getting the caption information that goes with that photograph, and then sees to it that it goes into the production phase for that publication. But often what happens, and again, this is it's not unusual in almost any industry. What happens is that you'll get somebody who's been elevated to the post of photo editor who's never had anything to do with either photographs or graphics, but rather they are a news person, and it, quite often it is a female. There seems to be an open ceiling in the photo area for blacks, females. All they're interested in is who can supply the best photograph. When it comes to editors, often it is an editor that is moved horizontally as opposed to vertically. They reach such a level that, yes, they're important, but they aren't on the cutting edge anymore of being a wordsmith editor, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they move them over horizontally. Oh, well, now you're in charge of graphics and photography. But they don't have any real knowledge of, again, the particular ethics that are involved. Let me give you a couple of examples if I can. Recently, Iran fired off 4 missiles, and it spread around the world the image that showed the 4 missiles and that they were taking off. You could actually see the stream of plume of smoke following the trail of the jet of the rockets as they were taking off. What happened, however, was that it spread around the world with these 4 rockets going off, appeared on the front page of the New York Times, etc. Except that if anybody had taken a look at the BBC's coverage in video, they would have noticed that one of the rockets failed and did not indeed take off successfully. So what Iran had done is that they had doctored the image. They had doctored the image to make it look as though they had no failure, that yes, all 4 missiles fired. United States newspapers, American newspapers, took it just on the basis of, yes, this is what occurred. Had they not had the visual video to reference it to, it might have passed on into history as, yes, Iran now has missiles that all fire very successfully, and this is, would complete the mission of what the Iran PR services would love. The difference, however, is that by making sure you check with video content, whether it's still or a video, always check all the sources. This is exactly what a good professional journalist does with his words, and that is that a journalist is not going to accept per se what somebody tells them, but rather they're going to use their own eyes. That's why they're in the field, by the way. It isn't so that they get to go have wonderful lunches in Paris and horrible lunches in Kabul, okay? It is because they need to be there to be the eyes for the publication that they work for.
What do you do when it's a staged photograph? I remember an African-American sports journalist on ESPN complaining, and I don't remember the name of the publication or the individuals, but they were complaining about the juxtaposition of a large African-American male athlete holding a female athlete, and maybe they were athletes of the year or something, I don't know, a white female athlete in his arms, hulking over, the African-American journalist was comparing this to King Kong carrying Faye Ray up the Empire State Building. And this is a posed photograph. This is not a candid, spontaneous situation. Don't photographers have to display a little more social sensitivity than that, given the historical depiction of African-Americans as apes in some very ugly situations that then was displayed in that particular situation?
Absolutely. But you probably were dealing with a photographer who was directed by a photo editor who probably was under 40 and has never experienced seeing those images that were used to make blacks look
like apes.
And also that was a directed photograph. So it should have appeared as photo illustration. They should have had in the credit line, it should have said photo illustration by. Photo illustration allows, legally, it allows you to do many things that you couldn't do by just claiming it was a documentary type photograph. But ethically also takes some of that weight off of the shoulder of whoever is shooting it. A good photographer, and by a good photographer, I mean that there are millions of photographers out there now, especially with the digital age, and we see a lot more photographs being supplied to news sources by non-professionals that are wonderful images, images that you could not get anywhere else, okay, because they happen to be there. Certainly images that have come from Hurricane Katrina and things like that are still very valid. They're still being used in insurance ads, things like that. But a good photographer, a good photojournalist, will never have one of their photographs interpreted as a photo illustration unless it has that label, photo illustration. That's what is so incredibly vital to good photojournalism. Now, racial or not, one of the things that has always intrigued me is that for years we've had photographers of different races, and certainly male and females, covering incredible news for us, who stood up for their rights. I've even known photographers who have taken film where they might have a couple of shots that were ambiguous, just that they were, there was no way of absolutely clarifying the images, so it did not have some kind of racial slant to it of some sort. And literally, in the old days when we had film, pull their film out and expose it so that nobody would ever get hold of it.
Mm-hmm.
They would rather lose their work than have that kind of thing go forward.
Like an unexpectedly catching FDR with his steel braces on his legs or something.
Absolutely.
Like that.
That was, as we've discussed in a previous program, FDR, by agreement by the photographers, was hardly ever photographed showing that he was a polio victim and had his braces, etc. You could not have that done now. And please, we could do an entire program of don't confuse paparazzi for photojournalists.
Right.
Paparazzi are a very special breed. And I think I said that without making it sound one way or the other as to how I feel about them. But paparazzi are there to cover the publicity-seeking stars of our time. That's basically what they're there. Yeah. Paparazzi don't show up at scenes of accidents unless Lindsay Lohan is in there with her lover.
Yeah.
Okay? Then they'll be there. Otherwise, it's of no consequence to them at all that this horrible accident had occurred or whatever. Whereas a photojournalist might try to somehow document that accident with or without a Lindsay Lohan and her lover.
Right.
To forewarn people that this particular stretch of road is notorious for accidents, maybe to illustrate that the economic slowdown is now going to mean that there'll be less money to repair roads and potholes and things. So there's great good that can come from a photojournalistic approach. And that's something that has, luckily for now, as far as I can tell from the profession, and I've been watching it now for 40-some-odd years, photojournalists are a haughty breed. If they go out there and if they're going to put themselves in harm's way, they want to see to it that the photographs speak very well for themselves.
Now, we've had situations with The Record in the past where we have taken photographs or had photographs taken of African American subjects, including Dr. Walker and Dr. McPhee, where either the lighting was bad or the backdrop was bad, or something was not right with the camera or something, but the particular individual's facial features became terribly indistinct, and
sure,
it was just one great big blur. Is it unethical in that case to try to lighten the picture or adjust the picture so that one may get a clearer image of the individual's face? That gets into dicey territory because, as we all know, some African Americans are lighter skinned than others.
Well, one of the things about Photoshop that has not been totally perfected yet is how you lighten a dark color without it going to a neutral gray.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can actually tell very easily if too much, what we call it, we refer to it as stepping on, if you've stepped on a photograph too much, if you've just done too much correction. Now, I would much rather that a photographer, and I've been photo editor at several different magazines and newspapers in my time. I'd much rather that a photographer came in where we had what looked like this a dark image and it's hard to make out the people involved. Because then the choice is, if they turn that in, gee, it's too bad and we can't run it, or it's so important for the information it contains. Here's this Dr. Walker or Dr. McPhee, and they're with somebody who represents maybe some children's group from overseas that MTSU has helped. Of course it's vital that we get that image out, okay? And also the other thing is, quite frankly, we should understand that photography isn't pristine.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes things happen, and yes, he may appear dark. To try to change that to make him appear to be a different tone is a very slippery slope, and it's best just left alone and make the decision whether or not to run the photograph itself or not. The whole idea of structure, there was a very famous quote that came out of a trial that a photograph contains the architecture of the scene that was presented to the photographer, and that at no time should you ever be able to go on in and change that basic architecture. You can't take out a wall. You can't do something as major as that, okay? So it comes back again to this whole idea of a reliance that your photographers are giving you the imagery that is truthful according to what they saw.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I don't know anything about photography, but if I did, I would take a pay cut if necessary to be the White House photographer right now, because I think that's going to be the most fascinating job over these next 4 years, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Callie Schell, who used to be at the Nashville, I think she was actually at the Banner before the Tennessean or whatever, went up with Al Gore when he was vice president, and also is now still, I think, shooting some at the White House. It's considered a wonderful job, except that it's never ending, okay? And it even drove one of the White House photographers to commit suicide.
Really?
Yes. Gosh, let me try and get the name right. I think it was Yoshi Yamamoto, who was Lyndon Johnson's White House photographer, and who Johnson let in on all these meetings. Before that, it had always been the traditional flash in the face, shaking mm-hmm. hands, and that was about it.
Yeah.
Well, they let Johnson let Yoshi into the private sanctum of the West Wing, and the so he was able to photograph all these things that were going on during the Vietnam War, of all the people meeting and discussing,
right,
and the look on the president's face. For the first time, that allowed people to really see what the stress was on a president. No longer was it he just comes into the camera and sits there and says, oh, this is a rough day, a rough time, but rather you could see it on the face of LBJ. And he later, Yoshi, later committed suicide. And some people say because it was the weight of what he saw and overheard.
Oh, my goodness.
The best photographers in the world, and I don't mean this as any bad statement to anybody, but the best photographers in the world are the ones who act as though they do not hear at all. Because then you're allowed into those inner sanctums and you can get the visuals that you're talking about. For years, I did gubernatorial campaigns. I'm basically out of Louisiana. And so I did Republican and Democratic and all sorts of different kinds of campaigns, Senate, governor, things like this all the time. And you would be surprised at what the people will talk about while you're in there taking pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have good ethics, you could just spill the beans on a lot of things that go on. But it is the trust that the people have that allow the photographers in. If you betray that trust, then no more visuals are going to be taken showing what the toll is on those office keepers.
Right. And I'm looking forward, though, on a happier note, to photographs of the Obamas with Malia and Sasha that are reminiscent of the photos of the Kennedys with Caroline and John. Playful moments.
I'm wondering how much they're going to pay for the pictures of the first dog. You know, I mean, some of these stars get $5, $8, and $10 million for their first baby. I guarantee you that there's a newspaper or a tabloid somewhere out there who already is offering $150,000, maybe even $500,000 for the picture. The first dog.
As long as the photographer doesn't try to pet him, because Barney's already bitten two journalists already.
There you go.
Drawn blood. Chris Harris, thanks for being with us today.
It's always a pleasure.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Loeb. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Go to mtsunews.com for the podcast, and we're available on iTunes.